This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
This meeting is being recorded.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football, History and its Memorabilia, on the Sports History Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridironbasemagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. Yes, from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to this afternoon.
Bob, it's been so long since we've done a show, you had to look down at your paper to remember my name.
refresh myself with our script. I was completely over, what's the word? Completely overwhelmed with trying to remember everything. And I was just confused in a way. But we're back.
Yeah, excited. You're zealous. You're like,
a little
I love it.
A little hiatus. As you know, and as I told some people, my daughter got married. She moved up the ceremony from October to April 6th, causing us to scramble to find flights, so on and so forth. So it was very, very interesting. But I did like Australia. I do know a little now about Australian rules football. A-R-F-L. And my son-in-law was filling me in on a little bit. We went by a couple of rugby/football stadiums in Australia there. No games were going on, so we're planning next time we go over there. He's going to take me to a game with some of his family members. And it should be interesting. But I don't know. It's a little different game. It's interesting. As he said, one game is fully pass. Rugby is fully passing, and the other one is more kicking. So it's interesting to see the differences there. But we had a great time. I mean, I fell in love with the country. Beautiful ceremony. It was raining 2 days. Monsoon rains over there before the wedding, and they were having the ceremony outside, so they had to move it to another part of the location they got married at. Mm-hmm. It all worked out well. We had it, and the coolest part about it is just reliving a day because you're caught in all the time zones. So when we left, we amazingly left Sydney 8 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, and we arrived in Raleigh at 5 o'clock that afternoon. That was unbelievable. Only 9 hours, which was basically 24 hours combined. So it was.
Congratulations, Bob. You've changed a little bit. Did you grow a mustache?
No, I still got it. My tan is, I got to work on it. We haven't been outside much because of the heat, and we're actually getting rain today. So,
are you sure? I don't remember you having a mustache before.
Oh, don't give me that. You know it. You know, I trimmed it back a little. Now it's all gray, though. That's the problem.
My handsome publisher of Gridiron Greats, my co-host. Of course, you've got a mustache. It's your famous for that.
Which puts on me, but again, I have a 1992 Dan McGuire dog tag, which cannot compete with, I heard you moved back into the house, Joe, and some showings. I know. The infamous Largent rookie.
Yep. Always have one handy just in case I have to show it off. But yeah, I was texting you. We've been in our house. I mentioned on previous shows, we had a house fire a couple years ago. So we moved back into our house in December, but the final boxes of contents, you know, were delivered last Saturday, you know, about a week ago. And my wife and Stacey and I have been going through them. And these are just all the little personal effects he didn't need. I mean, we had, you know, in December we moved in, you know, all the appliances, all the utensils, all the plates, all your clothes. I mean, you know, the clothes were delivered, you know, years ago or, you know, a while ago. But, you know, all the stuff you didn't need got delivered a week ago. So we've been going through boxes, and a lot of it's weird. It's, you know, stuffed animals you didn't need. It's clothes my daughter's grown out of, you know, that you're like, oh, geez, books. So, I mean, yep. It's kind of cool to go through old books, but I'm like you. You know, I'm a lot like you. I have a home office, and I really started to get into decorating my home office with the stuff I love, you know, my hobby, my collection. And I really loved my home office. I have a picture rail that ran, you know, pretty high up, and I was putting all my really cool collectibles up there.
Yep.
Well, after the loss, you know, they come and they grab that stuff and they take it away and they clean it. And I'd kind of forgotten a lot of it was missing. Well, a lot like you, that stuff was really dear to me. It was the stuff that I wanted to see every day when I came home. And you just kind of forget a lot of it's missing.
Right.
So I opened that box and lo and behold, staring up at me, some of this stuff, and it just immediately put a smile on my face. So as I was texting him, like, a lot of the stuff is stuff I wanted to share. You know, so I'm going to try not to catch the glint here, but this photo of Red Grange running right at you.
Beautiful.
This one is from 1923, December 14th, 1923.
Wow.
So this would be what his, you know, second week in the league.
Yep.
You know, right after he joined Thanksgiving of 23.
Wow. Wow, beautiful. You
recognize this one from the Shotwell cards. Excuse me, I'm trying to figure out where to go. That infamous brick wall from the Shotwell cards. This comes with a letter of authenticity from PSA, so you know it's good. Never get cheated.
I know that well.
One of my you've missed my sarcasm, haven't you, Bob? This is really trying not to, maybe I should turn my lights off here, but this one coming right at you again, another Red Grange.
You know, that the poses were so classic, were so, you know, stuff like that is so lost today. I mean,
yeah.
Look at some of the cards today and photos today. And, you know, you see guys with hairs down to their shoulders, so on and so forth, you know, with not even anything of, you know, anything relating to football and their pictures of it. And that's classic. I mean, that's just classic football poses.
I love it. I don't know if you can see it, but he's hitting a mark here.
Yep.
So it's kind of cool. You can see him coming up and turning on what I feel is some sort of, you know, spot to keep him from blowing a knee out. You know, that would happen later. But I mean, just I 100% agree with you. I mean, look at that pose, just turning and just, that's a statue right there. I mean, it's just such a beautiful pose. I'm hearkening back to the nickname, the Iceman.
Yeah.
You know, I like that one. Rumor would have it, that's where he got his legs and muscles from, with, you know, hauling ice up a stairway. But refrigerators put him out of a job there, technology.
Think of an NFL player today doing that for a summer a summer job. Because he's not making enough money and he wants to keep in shape. You know what I mean? Unbelievable.
Yeah. Concrete Charlie. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, hauling ice. Yeah, pretty cool. I wonder how much those ice blocks weighed. I wonder if it says that's an article. So I wonder how much they weigh.
They're probably a good 30, 40 pounds, if not more, I would say.
Yeah, it doesn't say, and I don't want to belabor, but this one, pretty cool. I really love it. Just look how cold that looks.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, and they didn't really have the heated benches and the warmers and stuff they do now. They just kind of went over to the bench, sat on a cold bench, and threw a blanket over them.
Yeah.
Switching gears, Jim Thorpe, president of the NFL, very hard at work. I'm sure signing some very important paperwork, you know.
Nice. That's nice. Beautiful.
Look at that desk. Look how busy that desk is. A lot of important work going on there, Jim Thorpe. Sorry, I'll zoom that in a little bit for you there, Joe. I can see you peering in. But yeah, I've always thought Jim Thorpe was obviously made the president to add some validity, you know, to the NFL and its fledgling leaders. So I would imagine most of the stuff that was put in front of him to sign was for, you know, posterity. So, you know, whenever I see him, you know, posing for pictures, signing stuff, I'm like, I'm sure that was a lunch menu.
Yeah.
You know? And again, probably the same office, you know, different angle, probably the same day for the photo op. But
yeah, sure.
I've never compared, you know, but is that the same jacket hanging on the same coat rack?
I wouldn't doubt it.
Different angle, you know, who knows? Jim Thorpe in later life, carrying a couple kids on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Gets that dad beer gut. And then this photo op with Red Grange and Jim Thorpe carrying a couple kids. I have a couple pictures of this. I've compared the tie on Red Grange. I have two or three pictures of this photo op day.
Yeah.
There's a couple with Grange with his jacket on and then a couple with the jacket off. And I know this is a tough one, but I've always really liked this photo.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of reminds you to stay humble. This is from 1954. This is from 1931, March 5th, 1931. 19 years before this was taken, Jim Thorpe was the greatest athlete in the world.
Right.
According to King Gustav.
Yeah.
You know, almost 20 years later, he'd be digging ditches. And it was said he didn't do this because he needed the money, that he did this because a friend of his called in sick and he did it to cover for his job because he'd be fired if he didn't show up.
Yeah. But
the slug on the back says the treatment accorded Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe said, "Hey, it helps keep me in shape and I don't mind the work." So, I mean, when they interviewed him on the day, he said, "I don't mind it. It helps keep me in shape." But later on, he said that that wasn't my job. It was, helping me cover. But this picture, to me, says, stay humble. You never know where you're going to end up. And, you never know when you're going to be bending the wrong end of a shovel.
That should be
this one.
That should be in every professional athlete's, every league should show that. To their players. Not that it would change a lot of them, but it may change one or two to actually wake up and see what they got. You know,
totally agree. Yeah. But that is from two gold medals, the greatest athlete in the world, you know, baseball, football, you know, just president of the NFL to digging ditches. I mean, it was a long, hard fall. I don't like it.
I agree.
And this one of my favorite items, and this is more for, you know, for our dear Jeffrey, but this.
Yep.
And I love our thread on VFC where, you know, Jeff said this is something I'm really looking for, and I was pretty happy to have it.
Yeah.
This is kind of a misnomer because it's just the cover of it. I don't have the whole program, but I'll take just the cover. This is the Thanksgiving Day Bears, Chicago Bears versus the lowly Chicago Cardinals. This is the Thanksgiving Day program from 1925. So this is it. Good program. Again, just the cover, but I'll take it. I love it. So that's it. Those were about 10, 12 of the items that were hanging around the picture rail of my office that were near and dear to me that I just unboxed. I thought you might enjoy it.
How many more boxes do you think you got to go through of your memorabilia? Do you have any idea, or are you pretty much
done? Done. I made it through all of it and got it all taken care of. I have one tube with an 86 uncut sheet with Jerry Rice on it. I have to put away, and all the memorabilia is done. I obviously just have some stuff to hang on the walls, and I'm doing pretty good. So.
That's great. That's great. I finally opened that one box I was saying I got in my little closet here. I did open it. I went through some of it, but I'm just going to leave it for now. I'm preparing for a three-day show in Columbia, South Carolina at the end of the month. So it should be interesting to set up there and see what's going on and see the pulse of football in Columbia. I did a show in Columbia a couple of years ago, but I did a very small show. This is supposedly the largest show in South Carolina. So it should be interesting to see what happens. So I'll be pushing the magazine, selling some stuff. And Brenda's coming with me, so we're going to have a, make it a little three-day getaway. It's not that far from here. It's only about 3.5 hours. So it should be an interesting experience setting up there. I am not making it official. I'm not either going or setting up at the National this year. So I'm taking a break from everything at a National. I'll miss meeting the guys. I won't miss the crowd. Chicago really did me in last year with 100,000 people going through that center. It was just, it was a zoo. That's all. That's the only way I can put it.
Yeah. So, last time I was in Cleveland, I can remember having dinner with you a couple times and sitting behind your table. That's my memory of Cleveland. I brought my son. So.
And I remember Xander did, what was it, like a Lego thing? He was, and he was playing with it. He was putting this whatever toy. I remember that it was like a toy. So yeah. It was pretty cool.
Gave him $20 to go buy some stuff. We're at a football, we're at a sports card convention. He comes back with a Lego box, and I'm like,
that was
cool. Grounded.
That was cool. All right, our special guest is here, and we're gonna shift gears here. Our special guest is a good friend of our podcast. He last was on in April of 2020. He's also a good friend of Gridiron Greats magazine. He's a member of the Pro Football Writers of America, and he is the author of 4 incredible pro football books. His newest one, and I'll plug it right now, on a very interesting season back with the Buffalo Bills and O.J. Simpson. He also edits the Facebook page, the NFL in the 1970s, which I enjoy. I try to check in. I don't have enough hours in the day to handle all the social media that is thrown at me, but I do try to pick and choose people I know and their websites and their pages and so on and so forth. He hails from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Our good friend, I'd like to welcome Mr. Joe Zagorski. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks also, Joe. I'm glad to be here again. I got to tell you, Bob, I spent a month in Australia.
Many
years ago when I was in the Army, we were deployed out there for a month, and I remember 10 o'clock tea times. And I also remember that we were not allowed to play Australian rules football against the Australians. Our captain felt that they would have killed us, and he was right, obviously. That's something that I remember most of all. And Joe, you mentioned some photos of Jim Thorpe. He was my father's favorite player, which goes to show you how old I am. That's a long time ago. So,
Dad had good taste.
Yeah, he did. He did. And, the 73 book on the Buffalo Bills is my fourth. And it's probably one of the more challenging books that I wrote because I knew that I was going to get into a lot of trouble if I did write it. But I also noticed. I noticed that not a lot of people really paid much attention to that team in that record-breaking season. And I thought that was a slight that that needed to be addressed in some way because it was such a monumental year. No one had ever run for 2,000 yards in a year.
Right. Now, what's interesting, Joe, about the book, and I was thinking about this yesterday, you are, to me, the specialist, the historian of the 1970s You know, you know everything. To me, you know pretty much everything in the 70s football era.
I wish.
You do. And I like the 60s era. And I think back to the 70s for me, graduating high school, going to college, working part-time, still collecting. But it wasn't the same for me because there weren't two separate leagues because the AFL merged with the NFL. And even back then, I just had a gut feeling the NFL never liked the AFL. So back then, because I basically only could watch three teams, the Giants, the Jets, and the Patriots, because I was in Connecticut at the time. So I saw two former AFL teams, AFC teams at that time, but I didn't, you know, the interleague games, so on and so forth. So I thought this book, and I'll talk a little bit about it when we get more into your book, but I thought this book really brought back some memories for me. And I do vaguely remember some of the times that you were writing about in that season. And I do remember the hype about OJ and all the, you know, all the yards he was running for. But to back up a bit, let's, if you could tell our audience again, how'd you get started about writing about football?
Oh, geez. Well, I had always been interested in it from the early 70s and wrote for my high school newspaper. And then later on, I wrote for a couple of newspapers in Pennsylvania where I was born and raised. And I, you know, covered sports. And one day I just realized, you know, I want to write a book about pro football and some aspect of it. But then I put that idea on the back burner. And it took a while until I could move it closer to the front burner, so to speak. And I eventually thought, you know, why don't I finally just write about this incredible decade that I grew up in as a kid. I was at a Pro Football Researchers Association convention when I ran into a publisher, and I told them what I was working on, and they asked me to send them a synopsis of it. I did, and they said that they really wanted to publish it. I thought, wow, somebody actually wants to read a book about this? So I finished writing it. It took me a total of 6 years to write that first book, the NFL in the 1970s. And that's the book. And, it kind of opened the door to me to other future projects, mm-hmm. which the 73 Buffalo Bills one was another one. But that didn't come about until later on. But that's generally how I started. It was just, you know, I wasn't getting any younger, and I figured I wanted to, you know, do something that would leave a legacy, you know. So that's what I decided to do.
That's great.
Joe, I love your book, The 2003 Art Odyssey. I mean, I knew about, I'm a couple years younger than the both of you. I knew about OJ's 2003 yard season, mostly from, you know, collecting, because that mm-hmm. happened a little bit before my time. I remember seeing the record breaker card when I was collecting, but mostly from when I remember when Eric Dickerson, you know, did it again, right. When I was watching. But I'm kind of a stat head, so I went back and, you know, looked at some of OJ's stats. On it, but I'll touch on that later. Tell us about your book, how you decided on the topic, and then, you know, how you put something like that together.
Well, it was, I guess, a few years before I even got a publishing deal to write my first book, when I was online and I was looking at different things, and I came across the name of Donnie Green, who played right tackle for the Buffalo Bills at that time in the early 70s. And it was one of those human interest stories that, you know, he had fallen on hard times and he was homeless. And that struck a chord with me. And so I read more about it. And eventually, as I got closer and closer to writing my first book, I decided to look this guy up, and I found him in Hagerstown, Maryland, of all places. And I started a conversation up with him, and I, you know, became good friends with him. He eventually got out of being homeless, and he moved into an apartment. But we would converse with each other over the phone like every other month for about, I'd say, maybe 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And we were he would tell me a little bit about that 73 Bills team. And eventually I got to the point where I'm thinking, you know, somebody's got to write a book on this. Nobody's written a book on this yet. And then I knew why. It's because nobody wanted to touch the subject of O.J. Simpson with a 10-foot pole.
Right. Right.
This was after the 1990s when, you know, all of his problems started, O.J. Simpson's problems I speak of. And so I decided to start working on a book little by little on the 73 Bills. And I figured, you know what? If not me, who? You know, so one thing is you learn as an author is that you really want to try to find a subject that nobody has written about yet, if you can. Now, in football, people would have come up to me, why don't you write about Tom Brady? Oh, I don't know. Maybe about 48 or 50 different books have been written about him already. You know?
Right, right. That's a good point.
And I'm not a famous author, so I'm a ham and egger. And so I try to pick something that no one's going to touch if I can. But it was still a topic that I thought would get at least some people in Buffalo to buy it. So I wrote about it. You know, unfortunately, Donnie passed away before he ever got to see it. But, you know, that's the way it goes. And you can never predict those sort of things. But my real coup was finally getting in touch and interviewing O.J. Simpson himself for the book. That was going to be a challenge, and I knew it was going to be a challenge because I was barking up the wrong tree. I was looking for O.J. Simpson when I should have been looking for his manager all those years.
Right, right.
I never was able to get in touch with O.J. Before I got in touch with his manager. Now, I did send O.J. a copy of my very first book, The NFL in the 1970s, when O.J. was incarcerated in Nevada. And I never found out if he even got the book or not until I interviewed
him. He had plenty of time to read it.
Well, yeah, you know, and you know, but that was a long book anyway. But when I got in touch with his manager, I told him what I was doing, and he goes, well, let me ask OJ and see if he's interested. And lo and behold, he was, as long as I submitted a list of the questions and promised that I wasn't going to touch on anything that he did in the 1990s. That involved murder, right. or any of the, you know, things that he was accused of doing. And so I promised that, you know, and lo and behold, one day OJ's manager calls me up, says, okay, we agreed to it. Now here's OJ Simpson. And I was in the middle of eating my lunch at the time, so I had to stop eating lunch so I could talk to OJ Simpson.
Holy moly.
Yeah, what a sacrifice, right? Anyway, I talked to Mr. Simpson for about 45 minutes, and all the while I'm talking to him and asking him these questions, I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm talking to O.J. Simpson. Oh my God, I'm talking to O.J.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, well, the bad side of it is that a lot of people still think of O.J. Simpson in bad terms. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe rightfully so. Everybody's got an opinion on him. But I hearken back to the 1970s. That's my mindset. And I was just so enthralled with the season that he had in 73 that, you know, I was really excited to talk to him. And I kept true to my word. I didn't ask him anything about, you know, what happened to him later on. But when I got to talk to other people after I finished the interview, people were, aghast that I would have the audacity to even talk to that guy.
Okay. I think Joe froze up there.
Yeah. Well, so anyways, it's interesting to try. Joe, you still okay? Joe, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. All right. It's interesting you say that because I know there's so much negative feedback about him over what happened. But if the way you wrote it, this is, I did read the book. And I do have a review coming for your honor.
Okay.
When I read the book and to read what his teammates said about him, yeah, that's the OJ I remember, seeing him in the commercials, seeing him in the movies, seeing him on as a broadcaster, as an announcer. He was a cool guy in his heyday.
Right.
And then, what causes people to do whatever they do, that is unknown to all of us. That's it. And you can't, we can't speculate on it. So I thought you did an amazing job. And I remember you had actually, I vaguely remember you emailed me or something. We chatted one time online and you said, I did actually talk to OJ Simpson. I'm saying, holy mackerel. I mean, how many people actually talk to the guy and reference his playing days? Now, we got Kerry Lavin in Gridiron Greats magazine. Kerry got a bunch of stuff OJ signed for him. And again, it was the same deal. You don't mention anything about what happened. And Kerry basically carried on a conversation with him just about football and about his Heisman year more than anything else. Now, you take it. And you take it into his professional career for that one season, which was truly an incredible season to run for 2,000 yards. So, that's amazing to me. And you did have an opportunity to actually interview him, which gave the book even more strength than what it had already. So, all right, I didn't mean to cut in on you, but I had to throw that out. So.
Well, I did find out something unique. Right towards the end of my interview with him, I had to ask him. I said, Mr. Simpson, did you ever happen to get that book on the 1970s in the NFL that I mailed you while you were in Nevada? And he goes, oh, yeah, I have it in my living room right now.
That's so great.
Yeah, I mean, he never got a chance to see this book on the 73 Bills, sadly. But at least I have the solace to know that he did get my first book and he did like it. So.
Good. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Wow.
It's really interesting. Joe, I apologize. I haven't, read the book yet, but it made me go back and just kind of relive it. So obviously there have been 8 people who have broken the 2,000 yard mark since then. Yeah. OJ was the only one to do it in a 14 game season.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Dickerson did it in 1984. OJ did it in averaging 143 yards per game, obviously, 14 games. No one comes close to that. Eric Dickerson did it 131 yards per game. So did Adrian Peterson. Just fascinating.
And, the thing is with those 73 Bills, they didn't have a passing game.
No.
They were running the ball practically every down. I mean, they were a lot. And so defenses were ready to stomp him.
He did.
There were only 3 games out of 14 that he didn't rush for at least 100 yards.
Right.
Yeah. I noticed he had 6 receptions that season. The entire season, 14 games out of the backfield, 6 receptions for 70 yards. So when they threw to him, they weren't expecting him to catch the ball. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah,
but
no.
I didn't realize. And he averaged 6 yards per carry, 143 yards per game. So he did it in 332 attempts, which was literally the least. So 14 games, 332 yards, 2,000 seasons. Barry Sanders did in 335. Chris Johnson's did in 358. So the least games, the least attempts, and the most yards per game. I mean, so he was a bruiser.
And he had it all. I mean, he had moves, he had speed, and, you know, he had resiliency. I mean, they, you know, back at that time, you could really tackle people. And, you know, and it was a runner's game back at that time. So he did benefit from the fact that a lot of his blockers were Big Ten blockers. And yeah. those guys were taught by Duffy Daugherty, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, run the ball, you know, no throwing it. We're running it. And that's what he did.
Here's something I didn't know about OJ. It took him a little while to hit his stride. I mean, his first year, you know, out of USC, he played in 13 games. He only had 697 yards. Yeah. He didn't start any of them. Second, you know, 1970, he only played in 8 games. 1971, started all 14, 742 yards. 72, all 14 games, 1,251 yards. So he hit his stride, and then he kind of went downhill really quickly. I mean, and man, when he went to San Francisco, yeah, he was done. But
oh, yeah.
Well, as good as they were in that 73 season, they got swept out by, I mean, the Steelers, that AFC was stacked for talent. The Steelers shut him down.
In 72, Lou Saban became Buffalo's head coach. And he told OJ, we're going to run the ball. And that was OJ's first year in leading the league in rushing. It's amazing. Oh. He led the league in 4 out of 5 years in rushing.
Wow.
The only person to break up his string was Otis Armstrong of Denver.
Yeah.
And OJ was pretty banged up in 74 when Armstrong won that rushing title. So, you know, Simpson still gained over 1,000, I believe, that year. But can you imagine leading the league in rushing 4 out of 5 years today?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, you're right. But look at that one playoff game he played in, 15 attempts, 49 yards. That's a Steeler defense. That's steel curtain.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting.
I know Steelers did, they did an even better job the following week in the AFC title game against Oakland. They got, I think, as a team, under 30 yards or in that neighborhood. And then, of course, 2 weeks later in Super Bowl IX, Minnesota got 17 whole yards rushing.
Correct.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they were that good. Wow.
I still remember that Super Bowl well because I really thought Minnesota had some sort of chance. But when Pittsburgh was just overwhelming to Minnesota, Minnesota was just like lost on the field in that game.
I think Minnesota could have won that game. I think if they would have came out there in the third quarter and just stopped running the ball altogether and just throw the ball on every down, eventually those Steeler defensive backs were going to get a little bit tired.
Right, right.
But they didn't do that. And so,
you know, that's a good point, Joe, because it's interesting to me in a Super Bowl game, if something's not working and you're at halftime, you have to change your plan. I mean, you're the biggest game. You got 30 minutes to win the game. And you do the same exact thing that didn't work in the first half and the second half, and you know you're going to lose. I mean, you know, it's amazing. It's really amazing. I always remember that about that Super Bowl. To me, Pittsburgh just looked, you know, incredible.
But they were going to stop the run that day. There's just no. The Vikings didn't have an O.J. Simpson in their offensive backfield.
Right.
Exactly. But even if they did, they weren't going to run for a lot of yards. Throwing the ball was their only real option, and they didn't really take advantage of it.
Exactly. I know I'm a little biased toward the Packers, but I still love your book on the 72 Packers. That's my favorite. But what was different I'm curious, and our listeners, I'm sure, are curious also. What was different about this book than your three other books? And again, the book on the 70s, the 72 Packers, and Willie Lanier. What was actually different for you writing about it? We know the OJ thing plays into the, you know, a big difference in the book itself. But what else could you comment or fill us in on about that?
The hardest thing I had to deal with was finding a publisher for it.
All right.
Nobody, you know, when I mentioned the words O.J. Simpson, nobody really wanted to even touch it. And it took a while till I finally found a publisher for it. I think as far as writing it goes, I wanted to try and get as many interviews from the players as possible. I think I got about the same amount as I did for the 72 Packers book. But I also wanted to get more research. And so I was able to find play-by-play information for those games.
Yeah.
So I put OJ's carries in it for each one of the games, and where the ball was intended to go, the yardage, down and distance, the result of the play. I added that in for some spice, a little bit of salt and pepper to help the book along, make it seem more like I'm a real researcher.
Yeah. I was going to comment on that. Yeah, I thought it was very informative and interesting that you did add that into the book, because you could actually see the play-by-play of what OJ did in each game. So you actually got a much better picture of what was actually going on the field. And again, you could go back and look at YouTube videos or highlight shows and so on and so forth, but to actually see it play by play gives the reader, to me, a much greater understanding of what's going on. And again, you're right, nobody wrote about it before. So therefore, it was something completely new as far as a subject was concerned. So I thought that was a really good part of the book, a very, very interesting part of the book.
Thanks. Thank you.
So again, I could see why publishers would turn away from trying to publish because of OJ, but I'm glad you did find it. And they did a nice job promotion. I mean, I saw you got nice little bookmarks. And your tears.
I asked them for more bookmarks, and they said no.
Really? Well, yeah. People don't read physical books anymore, so that's part of the problem. So it's fair. I actually have a collection. If there's a book that comes out and they do publish a bookmark, I do try to keep the bookmark as a piece of memorabilia to the book, because I know. We know paper supposedly is bad, so therefore we want to eliminate it at all costs. But I thought that was a great addition to your book there.
So, yeah, I thought it wouldn't have cost them with the amount of royalties that they're going to get. You would think that they would give me maybe 20 more bookmarks.
Yeah,
you know.
They gave me two. I can send you one back. I'll throw it in on the oven.
Yeah, but I'm feeling very generous today, Joe. You should take him up on that.
Send one to Joe. You know,
yeah. this dog tag I got of McGuire. So since I found it over here.
Yeah, love it. when you're writing a book like this, Joe, I mean, you're compiling data, stories, you're interviewing people. There's got to be a couple eyebrow raisers. Do you have any good stories you can share? I mean, with our listeners.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's an excited. Oh yeah.
A couple ones are, you know, I was able to somehow talk Mr. Simpson into telling me some of his stories of his movie making days. And I remember him telling me the story about when he first started working as an extra in Hollywood. And this is during his playing days. He would spend his summers at the movie studios because he went to USC. And I believe he had already established himself as being a very famous running back there. And so he, you know, as he was kind of like a more of a stunt actor than anything else. And they needed him in one scene for this movie, Death of a Gunfighter. I think that what it was the title of the film. And yeah, I think it, one of the stars was Lena Horne. Anyway, he and Earl McCullough, who were, he was also a USC guy. They were both, he went to play for Detroit. Anyway, they were both in this one scene where they were supposed to run down this, it's a Western film. They're supposed to run down this street while somebody's shooting. And they were both world-class sprinters at the time. And so that's what they did. And then they had to reshoot the scene because they were running too fast. And, you know, the director said no. Now, you know, full circle, years, a few years later, O.J. Simpson's filming that miniseries, Roots. And he's supposed to, you know, chase down the one of the main actors in this film, LeVar Burton. And, you know, when we're watching it on television, he does that rather easily. But in reality, it wasn't so easy. LeVar Burton knew about O.J. Simpson's pedigree as a running back. So LeVar Burton got his track shoes on, basically, and he sprinted. And O.J. was out of shape, admittedly. And it took several takes for O.J. to finally catch him. So LeVar Burton's claim to fame that he could outrun the NFL's MVP. And, that's, you know, that's, but those are some of the unique things, that, and they're both in the book. And then one of the stories that Donnie Green told me one day was when he and Reggie McKenzie, his fellow offensive lineman, and O.J. Simpson go to the movies, go to the, you know, the theater, and Donnie and Reggie want to see one film, and O.J. says, no, no, we want to see this one. Well, O.J. won the debate, and so they go to see this one film, and Donnie and Reggie weren't really sure which one it was. They couldn't remember, but they sat down, started watching the movie, and then O.J. Simpson's name shows up on the screen as, you know, in the opening credits, and they're both laughing their butts off, and, you know, that's why O.J. wanted them to come and see that film so they could watch him on the screen.
That's funny.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, a little sidebar. What are your personal thoughts on O.J.? I mean, you interviewed him. You weren't allowed to ask him about the subject, that subject being, you know, right, murdering two people. And I mean, and like it or not, I mean, when he was incarcerated, it was for, you know, kidnapping and holding a couple people up. I mean, it's, what's your personal opinion on the guy? Football accolades aside,
I think that you're almost dealing with two different guys. I think that when I talked to two of the players, of the Bills players, one said that he thought he was guilty, and another said he didn't think he did it, and that's in the book. I personally resigned myself to the belief that he probably is guilty of the second crimes, the civil court rulings, as far as, you know, holding somebody up for memorabilia. You know, I'm guessing that he's probably guilty of that. But as far as potential murders go, I don't know. I say in the book, it's not my position because I'm not his judge. I wasn't in the courtroom. I didn't hear the evidence. I didn't watch it on television. All I heard were, you know, little sound bits here and there. And yeah, I wasn't in a jury. I wasn't involved in that at all at the time. I've had friends tell me that, a couple of friends told me, you know, they think that OJ might have been suffering from CTE at the time. Uh-huh. And that rage might have taken over, like it did with Jim Tyrer of the Kansas City Chiefs. with his fate, murder suicide, and that's, you know, that did happen. And, but I don't really give an opinion in the book of my own opinion, because I didn't think that was, I just didn't think that the book deserved that.
Yeah, good point.
I just didn't, the book, I wanted to focus on the 73 Bills, not on the 93 Simpsons.
Yeah.
And so, that's generally, you know, I can't say if he did it or not, Joe, I'm sorry. Because
you worded that really well. I really liked the way you put that. The 73 Bills, not the 93 cents. But you worded that very well.
You know, reading what you said in the book, and to me, it was very logical and it made a lot of sense. And I do agree with you with what you're saying about the memorabilia, stealing the memorabilia. And I'm saying to myself, why would he do something like that? I mean, to engineer that whole process of getting his stuff back was stupid, in my opinion. And he paid for it. And you know, what was the point of it? How much was there, type of thing? It was it going to be really make that big of a difference in his life? We, you know, obviously we'll never know. And because of that, it's problematic to his career, so on and so forth, and his legacy with everything that happened. But, you know, that's the reality of the situation. And again, you know, I personally, you know, going back to the trial and all that, I was just sick of hearing the thing. And I had people, because I was in my infancy, writing about memorabilia, so on and so forth. You know, I had a couple of papers ask me locally, well, what do you think? You think he's got to be guilty, blah, blah, blah. And I said, it's up to the jury to decide it. I'm not going to say one way or the other, because I don't know. I do not know what happened, you know.
And that's the book itself is problematic. And I knew it was going to be problematic.
Yeah.
But I knew I had to write, you know. Yep. And I couldn't get the publisher. My biggest thing was being upset with my publisher, because they kept dragging their feet on it, and it should have been out last year.
Yeah.
And if it would have been, Mr. Simpson would have gotten a chance to at least see it.
Right.
So, but I worked as fast as I could. And even though Marv Levy did not coach those Bills at that time, I knew he'd be the perfect person to write a foreword to it, because he was a coach in the NFL during that 1973 as an assistant. And who doesn't in Buffalo, who doesn't know Marv Levy?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And plus, you know, when you're somebody like myself, you're not going to get famous people to say yes a whole lot to write a foreword.
Yeah.
My first book, the first person I asked was Roger Staubach, and his secretary told me no, he's too busy. And I asked Fran Tarkenton, his secretary told me no, he's too busy.
Yeah.
Then I asked Brent Musburger, and I didn't get a response from him. And then I asked Rocky Blyer, and he said, sure, I'll write it. And then a week after Rocky says yes, Brent Musburger calls my apartment up and says, yeah, I'll write it. I'm sorry, Brett, but you're a week too late. And I told him I got Rocky Blyer instead. He goes, oh, he's a good guy. He'll write a good job for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, how many people get Brent Musburger to call their apartment up? You know, so I kept.
Rocky Blyer has a little more star power than Brent Musburger, I would think, too.
Well, I wanted somebody that played or had something to do with that decade.
Right.
And not just 1 year or 2 years, but the majority of the years. And I needed somebody who was articulate enough to write, you know, a little bit. And so, if you get like a guy like Staubach or Fran Tarkenton, everybody knows him.
Yeah.
Knows those guys. Rocky Blyer, not everybody knows him, but certainly everybody in Pittsburgh does.
Yeah.
And so I put him on the cover.
Yeah. That's cool. All right, we're almost out of time, Joe. Can you tell our audience how they can buy your four books, which I believe all four should be in any person's football library?
Especially. Thanks, Bob. You can get all four of them on Amazon.com, but the most recent one on the 1973 Buffalo Bills, you can buy the paper copy, the actual book itself on Amazon. But if you want electronic, the Kindle version, you're going to need to go to Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
All right. But all the other books are available on Amazon.com.
Okay, that's good to know. And I reiterate, Joe, you really have a great book on your hands. I really enjoyed reading it. It was another deal. I drive Brenda crazy because where I sit and read, I got like 6-7 books lined up there. Because I get a lot of books from people wanting even non-football books to review, so on and so forth. But I sat down with your book, and it's like almost midnight, and Brenda comes on and said, "Are you coming to bed tonight, or what's going on?" I said, I only got about 15 more pages. I got to finish this tonight, and I'm done. Okay. It was a one-sitting book, and it was great, and it brought back a lot of great memories for me from the 70s of the game that we used to know. And it was interesting that week. I've been going through all my sets. I did pull out the 73 set, and I looked at, and a lot of those guys. So it was cool. It was cool seeing that. But I think you really got a hit on your hands on this one. Just got to get some publicity on it and get some people to buy it so they can go into second and third printings. And I wanted to say this. I truly am humbled by your what you wrote to me in the front of the book. I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. So.
Oh, thanks, Bob. I can't remember what I wrote, but that's okay because I'm getting old.
it was very nice. Trust me, it was very humbling for me. So I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, hey, thanks a lot for interviewing me today, Bob and Joe. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, you work. No worries. You guys take care of yourself. Now have a great summer.
Okay. You too, Joe. Take care.
All right. Bye bye.
All right. We got 2 more minutes, and we got to go into a quick 2-minute wrap up. I got the, here's the bookmark for the book.
Oh, wow.
I do have
a really good shot.
I'm using the other one in another book, and they did a nice cutout, tear page. And you can order the book on the back, so on and so forth. Hand it off to you, Joe. What'd you pick up on today's show?
What a great guy. I remember him, I remember him from April of 2020. Once you mentioned the date, I'm like, oh, I remember that. That was a weird time, but
oh, yeah.
Great author. I remember buying his other book. Great author. He writes in a really good style. That's just, here it is. Tough subject. I would agree. I don't know if I would be able to write about OJ just because, I mean, he's absolutely right. But the way he put a bow on that, I'm writing a book about the 73 Bills, not about, the 93, Simpson. He really does a good job of separating it. So I was really impressed.
And in reading the book, and just shows to me the professionalism Joe has, I understand from a writing standpoint what he was saying today. The story had to be told. And again, we have hundreds of books on Brady, hundreds of books on whoever. Yeah. There's a lot of real classic NFL history that still hasn't been written about. And that's one of the areas that needed to be written. All right, we're almost out of time. Got 1 minute. Final thoughts, 10 seconds, Joe.
So good to see your smiling mustachioed face back here, Bob. I've missed you. Nice to rekindle our Gridiron podcast.
We're gonna be getting moving on it now. I'm back in the swing of things, and we'll be getting a few more guests coming on. I'm just trying to arrange times, and we'll be going in the future. If you're not subscribed to Gridiron Grace Magazine, what are you waiting for?
Gridiron.com.
Till next time. Thanks for watching.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.